and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Saturday Afternoon with me, Carolyn Yeager. It is April 5th, 2014. My topic today is occult Nazism and whether there is or ever was such a thing. We know Nazism is an incorrect term. When the correct name, National Socialist, is used, it's almost impossible to connect it with anything mystical or occult. But Nazism lends itself much better, and we have concepts like esoteric Nazism, occult Nazism, even spiritual Nazism, which, in my opinion, is intended to bypass the racial element altogether. I have become convinced that Nazi is not a word that should be used after all, that it should be avoided whenever possible. I have a guest, the well-known Charles Kraft, coming on in a half hour. He's interested in this subject, too, and has looked into it from the point of view of military intelligence and popularizing of the theme via military intelligence books and movies. So I will, at this point, make a correction. Before I go any further, I want to make this correction and something of an apology. Just something, for the last line of the program announcement that connected David Cole with the cannibal commandant of Natzweiler, which it turns out is a mistaken idea from some confused communication, and there is a last minute stuff, you know, and turns out there is no accusation of anyone being a cannibal by David Cole or anyone else. However, David did get a plug for his latest interview, so he shouldn't mind too much. We'll be saying more about that interview at the end of the show, so therefore I best be moving along with the topic so there will be time for it. Occultism has been said by someone, I'm not sure who here at the moment, but called it a symptom of alienation from society. I know it's from this book review of Goodrich Clark's book, this person wrote this, that occultism is a symptom of alienation from society, but it is also a symptom of alienation from reality itself, an insight anticipated by another T.S. Eliot line, T.S. Eliot, the English poet, and it goes like this: humankind cannot bear very much reality. That's it, quote unquote. In a sense, there is a magic to occultism. After all, it is possible to create a fantasy world in one's mind that blots out reality. Excuse me. I thought that was pretty good. And I would say it's possible to create anything in one's mind. And because thought is the creator, that's some of my thoughts. But things can become real if we believe they are, and the more we believe it, the more real they become. That's not what this show is about, so I won't go any further. A little factoid here that I think I'll mention right in the beginning is, to set the stage, so to speak. And this comes from a Wikipedia page. I don't know which, what the heading of the page was, but something about, occult Nazism, probably. The full focus of the state, it says, was not aimed at religious groups until the 9th of June, 1941, when Reinhard Heydrich, the head of the security police, banned lodge organizations and esoteric groups in the wake of the flight to Scotland by Rudolf Hess, who had been attracted and influenced by the organic farming theories of Rudolf Steiner. And Rudolf Steiner was an Austrian who started this movement he called Anthroposophy, which was a kind of a switch from the theosophy of the theosophy movement of Annie Besant. He broke away from that and started his own, but he was into organic farming theories, it says here, which Rudolf Hess was attracted to. Rudolf Hess was attracted to a lot of this kind of thing Well, let me continue with this quote. It says, however, the suppression of esoteric organizations, the page says, began very soon after the Nazis acquired governmental power, which was this Dr. Anna Bramwell, who is a, you know, one of a respected, supposed respected historian of the period, points out that occultist racialists were banned as early as 1934. So we want to know that that Heydrich in 1941 banned lodge organizations and actually banned them from Germany. But in 1934, they were banned from the party. If you were an occultist racialist, that is, if you thought that racialism was, you gave the reasons you believed it was because of some mystical reasons in the past or some thing that was handed down from the dim ages of Germanic, old Germanic history, things like that. That was not, they didn't want any of that. Hitler didn't want any of that at that point already. I was just going to mention, I'm going to end up taking too much time here, but I do know that Hermann Giesler, who wrote his memoirs about with his time with Adolf Hitler, one part that stays in my mind very much is when after Hitler had gone to see Franco in Spain and come back dissatisfied with what he got from Franco, and he was having lunch in a restaurant with Giesler, and he said to Giesler that he was worried about Rudolf Hess because of all his odd beliefs. That's about all it was, you know, that he was concerned about that. But now Hitler accepted, up until that point, this was wartime now, Hitler accepted the personal beliefs and inclinations and of his close associates, one of which was Rudolf Hess, another one was Heinrich Himmler, who had ideas that Hitler didn't agree with, but he didn't interfere with any of that. But at certain points, he stood up against some things. And so that's just a little background for this particular portion there. But what I'm going to present today actually is what I consider to be fact, not fancy. Flights of fancy would be an appropriate way to put it. And I come up when I've been coming up against some, arguments about that go like this. I've got two of them here. Argument number one. Carolyn thinks she owns Hitler and can determine what can and cannot be said about him. Carolyn thinks only she is right. Well, what I say is that I believe Hitler cannot be interpreted loosely to suit everyone's taste and agenda. For example, saying that National Socialism is a spiritual idea of character traits, not a racial ideal, which is just simply not what it was intended to be. So it's taking National Socialism away from Hitler and making it into what you want it to be and still calling it the same and using the Hitler imagery and so on. Another part of this argument is that another answer of mine to this argument is that there are those who want the Hitler, this goes along with the first one, they want the Hitler aura and reputation and appeal to so many people without accepting the actual beliefs that Hitler held. And this is common amongst Muslims, Arabs, and other non-whites who want to say that Hitler didn't hold to that racial ideal, that it's all about the kind of person you are. Now, my other answer is that those people who say this are just sloppy and just accept things they read here and there. They like this, they like that, and they're attracted to it without checking whether it's factual or not and or being skeptical enough about it. And so for me, the real Hitler message is too important to be watered down or subverted or put to use for goals in which Hitler did not share or advise. And argument number two that comes forth is that everyone, and it's very much a part of what I already said, that everyone can have their own opinion of Hitler's beliefs we don't know, you know, exactly what he believed. It's all interpretation. Therefore, people can take what they want from it. People can take what they want from Hitler and National Socialism and fit it in with other philosophies, even New Age thinking and mysticism, and that in the end, Hitler belongs to everyone. Well, when somebody becomes a very well-known figure, you can't stop it. But I disagree with that, that's not really, when you start changing who Hitler was and what he would stand for, then you don't have Hitler anymore. And I don't like this idea of things becoming, symbols rather than real people. So, need to move on here. Our friend Marcus, my friend Marcus, I call Marcus a friend. I like a lot of what Marcus says, and he's given me a little help here because, to get going on this particular program, because it was like 2 weeks ago already, he said a couple of things in a comment at the White Network, which I disagreed with so much, and he just threw them off, you know, just said them like there was no problem with it. And this is exactly the kind of thing that I see as it points out what I'm talking about. He said, what would National Socialism be without Maria Orsic, a Croatian, supposedly a Croatian young woman? And I thought that was really quite out of place. National Socialism would be everything that it is without Maria Orsic. She didn't have anything to do with it. But I thought that was, you know, and he didn't even know that much about her, but he just said it. Things like this are what people say, all right? Then the next one, it makes more sense. It's more commonly what so many people think. He wrote the Thule Society, that's spelled T-H-U-L-E, Thule Society is the basis of National Socialism. Well, a lot of people believe that, and they say so and so on, and there is a certain connection. There's a connection, but I'm going to go into that very shortly, but it certainly is not the basis, and Hitler didn't want it. Hitler even cut the connection, what connection there was, as soon as he took charge of the DAP and turned it into the NSDAP. Way back then in 1922, I think. So, even 21, maybe. Now I'm going to start here and I'm going to go through some of the history of what would be connected to what would turn out to be occultism in National Socialism. And I'm going to do that as fast as I can. You know, there was always a Volkisch movement containing a Volkisch movement in Germany and in Austria. And the first name I have here is Georg von Schonerer, who was an exponent in Austria of Pan-Germanism. And his movement had a strong anti-Catholic element because the Catholic Church was very preferential in Austria to the Slavic people. And he was against too much Slavic people. But this was... you know, he calls it Austria, but this was in the end of the 19th century. And so it was part of it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire with, you know, a multi-ethnic empire. But the German Austrians were more concentrated in the West and the Slavs were, you know, Vienna was the capital, so they were all over there. Well, he was, you know, there was a feeling amongst the Germans that they wanted their own, they wanted to be pro-German, and they didn't want like this incursion of Slavs. And so Schonerer was, in essence, against Slavic immigrants and for pan-German unity. Now, then there came along this person, Guido von Liszt, who believed that the Germans had this, you know, he's very much a mystical person. He believed they had an advanced civilization long before the Roman Empire. He was looking into that stuff, and a lot of it was just things he interpreted for himself. He was a Wotanist, and he believed, but he, well, there's, you know, there's criticism of him here. I'm not going to go into it. I'll just say basically he interpreted, what he did was he interpreted folk tales, place names, and heraldic symbolism as a kind of secret code that he thought he had decoded, as seeing an ancient Aryan priesthood and with occult teachings that he was trying to pass on. He was anti-Christian also. Then there was the Germanen Orden, was founded in Munich in 1912. A lot of this stuff went on in southern Germany and Austria. And it was a secret anti-Semitic organization meant to counteract the Jewish conspiracy to control Germany. What it saw is that. In 1918, the leadership of this organization was taken over by this Rudolf von Siebotendorf, who played a large part from here on in and from until 1945, in and out and of these various in and out of Germany and in and out of these organizations and so on. But he got very interested in occultism too. And he was, let me see, what more can I say about him? He is the one, his Germanen Orden, or kind of a German order that he started. He, at some point, let's see, when was that? During the Weimar Republic, he changed the name of it to the Thule Society and transformed it into an organization of political activists dedicated to destabilizing the Weimar Republic. So the Thule Society had people who were interested in occultism in it, and then it had people who were interested in building up the German Volk, you know, Volkism, I guess you could call it, that kind of thing. So it wasn't really an occult organization. It was a pro German organization just as much. And then there was this Ostara magazine published by Lanz von Liebenfels. And Ostara is the name of the pagan goddess of spring, but it was a good magazine. And, supposedly, Hitler read that magazine, in his early years. He met with Lanz a couple of times to get back issues and discussed his theories, on race, because it was, pro-racial, pro-anti-Semitic editorial point of view. So there you have a little connection there of Hitler with that. Mostly it's all based on the racial idea. But, you know, looking at what these people are doing. So now this Thule Society that Siebotendorf started, it was considered to be, as I said, both occultist and Volkish. It was in Munich. I'm not going to go into, but he actually started, this Siebotendorfer, started the German Workers' Party, or the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the DAP, in his effort to move his organization away from occultism to a Volkish point of view, and a pro-German workers' point of view. In order to be more successful and to counteract the communist workers' power, which was international. So you had this thing between the internationalist theories for the workers and the pro-German theories for the workers. And, of course, there was always some anti-Semitism involved in it, seeing the Jews as a big problem. So this was the party then. He wanted to destabilize the Weimar regime. But this was the party that Adolf Hitler looked into for the military that he was still attached to after the war. And then he liked it, and he got up and spoke at it, and he had such a great reception. And then they sent him an invitation to become a member. And he thought about it for a while, and he decided, okay, this is where I'll begin my political career. with this party. He decided to go ahead and do it. So he joined, and quickly they made him head of it. It didn't take too long. And then he changed the name. He had been developing his National Socialist ideas. So this is how the Thule Society is connected with the NSDAP. This is the only connection there is, and it didn't last very long, because shortly in 1934, he cut all the ties with the Thule Association because he didn't want any of this occultism in his party or associated with his party. Now, Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who has written some books on Nazi occultism, but he actually is better on it than someone like Ian Kershaw, who is a famous British historian and fancies himself an expert on Hitler and National Socialist period. He has written that all these major figures in the NSDAP were members of the Thule Society and were sympathizers with this. And he says that Rudolf Hess, Alfred Rosenberg, Hans Frank, Julius Lehmann, Gottfried Feder, the economist, Dietrich Eckart, who you should all know, and Karl Harrer were all members of the Thule Society. But Nicholas Goodrich Clark corrects that. He's done more and deeper research into it. He admits that only Hans Frank and Rudolf Hess had been actual members of the Thule Society, and not for very long either, but they were the most interested in it. And the others that are mentioned as being members were only had been invited as a guest to come to a particular meeting, big special meeting of some kind or some banquet or something. And they accepted, and they were at this. That's all. They went. Probably maybe Rudolf Hess invited them. But they were never members. And it's also clear that Hitler himself never, ever attended the Thule Society in any way, shape, or form. Now, I'm not trying to, I have nothing against the Thule Society. Sounds pretty good, interesting, and like they were doing a good thing. They were trying to stand up for good things. But it's just the fact that it doesn't really have any connection. All these National Socialists that people like to list off were not members of this society, and only those two, and they didn't ever take a big part in it, and they, you know, joined. Rudolf Hess was quite the joiner, I think, of things. He was very curious. He had a lot of interest in a lot of things. He's always looking into things. Like Himmler, had a lot of interest in things. There's nothing wrong with that. But just let's get the facts straight. So going on, we're in 1918, after the end of the war and all these uprisings and so on, the Thule group organized a citizens' uprising as the white troops. I don't know if this was exactly the Freikorps yet, but the white troops entered the city to calm it down, the city of Munich, in May 1st, 1918, because the communist government took over in Munich previous to that, and they were raiding the Thule Society. So it was like open warfare there between these, and the Thules organized a citizens' uprising. And then it was in 1919 that Anton Drexler of the German Workers' Party organized his party. He was a member of the Thule Society, and Adolf Hitler joined this party, but not the Thule Society, as well. I already told you about that. And this was in 1919. By the end of February 1920, now the German Workers' Party had become the National Socialist German Workers' Party. So that was the next month, the month after it was formed. It had just been formed. And then it came under Adolf Hitler's leadership. So, Charles, know that you can call in anytime, and I'll see it. I'm looking here for what else I want to say. Oh, yeah. Then there was this horrible book, Before Hitler Came. It's written by someone named, it said that Rudolf von Sebottendorf wrote that book, and he published it himself, but it has a different author's name on it, who's supposed to be a school teacher from Germany. I always thought that was the real author, this school teacher. It's written by someone named Dietrich Bronder from Germany. It's the one that said that Hitler first came to the Thule Society, and that it was really, it was behind everything. It was very false, and it named all these people who then became big in the National Socialist Party as being members. And anyway, when this book came out in 1933, and the National Socialist regime didn't like it, so this would have been after he was in power. So Hitler had the power to suppress the book, and he also suppressed all the esoteric organizations that were closed down by anti-Masonic legislation.
Hello?
Hi, Charles.
Hi.
You've been listening, so you know what I've been saying. I'm trying to get through this business. I'm still on the Thule Society. Anyway, how are you today?
I'm okay.
So I was just still talking about the Thule Society, as you probably know. And Dietrich Bronder's book came out in 1964, but it's the same title, Before Hitler Came, Bevor Hitler Kam, in German. So I'm a little confused about that, and I didn't get that straight, but it's the same book. Supposedly it was published in 1933 by this C. Bottendorf. It's full of lies. It's full of lies, and yet it's used all the time by people who want to have this version of National Socialism that they like to call Nazism and Nazis and so on. And all these Nazis, the same list of names, but now we've got Heinrich Himmler included in the newer version, and Alfred Rosenberg, supposedly, too. I may have mentioned him before. And Hermann Göring also has been, oh, no, here's a bunch of new names. Karl Haushofer are mentioned in this 1964 version by Dietrich Bronder. But it's one of the things that's used by Jim Condit, and it's brought up by people who want to have this, maybe you'd say, alternative view of Hitler and his party and Third Reich. Anyway, it's not factual, and it shouldn't be referenced, but it is. So that's one of the things. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
I'm familiar a little bit with Sabatendorf, and you're saying that this is a book that is by Sabatendorf, or what? What are you saying?
Well, yeah, I mean, I read that Sabatendorf wrote it and put it out and published it in 1933, and it's given this title. It says, in that year, 1933, he published a book entitled Before Hitler Came, in which he claimed the Thule Society had paved the way for the Führer. And so on, and named all these people, and then Hitler banned the book and closed down a bunch of these esoteric organizations. Not because he was afraid of this information coming out, but because it was wrong. And, he didn't want this stuff connected with his party and his regime, which was just enemies, really, who thought that would, you know, help their cause, because he never was involved in this stuff.
Well, last night I was looking over some of the material that you're discussing today, and apparently in Mein Kampf, he calls these people like Sabatendorf and the other occultists and New Agers in the Wilhelmine, I guess it would be called, racist wandering scholars, and he didn't like them.
Racist wandering scholars?
Yeah, racialist wandering scholars. They were... The idea about the Aryan, Ariosophy was something about extraterrestrial Aryan origins. Do you know anything about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, they got involved into things like that. But not everybody believed everything who were even members of these groups, but some of them went further than others. And it was all supposed to be about Germany and finding the real true Germany and uplifting the German people, that they were the best in the world, I guess. But he didn't like it, and he knew it was baloney. So, but a few people in the party were attracted to it, as we have now so many people attracted to it. So I'm just trying to point out that this stuff should not be given any weight.
there's a scholar, and I can't remember exactly where she's teaching, but her name is Corina Treitel, and she's sort
Probably,
of
yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you run across her?
Yeah, I did.
I think it's the same one. Is Nicholas Goodrich Clark's opponent in this idea that the NSDAP was filled with occultists.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's what I was reading about her. Yeah, she sounded pretty good. She's a German woman, obviously from her name. And for whatever reason, they're trying to get she just maybe wants to get the facts straight. But Goodrich Clark is not as bad about, you know what Goodrich Clark does? He writes a book to sell that's like, everything about occultic Nazism and so on. But he's a good enough historian or scholar that he disputes most of these claims that some of the others don't. And he is the one who said that the only members of the Thule Society were short period of time were Hess and the other guy, Carl's, the one who ran Poland. And
Frank.
Frank, yeah, Frank. Thanks. And that Hitler never belonged to any of this and didn't ever show any interest in it. And in matter of fact, started banning it when he had the ability to do so.
Well, I believe that there was an occult department of the Annenerbe. Was there not? That was.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We'll get to that. Let me finish up here with the Thule Society. I'm kind of a systematic, organized person. So,
okay.
One thing I want to do, if you'll bear with me, Charles, is that there's this Nuremberg speech by Hitler in September 1938, and there's this, you know, at the Nuremberg Party Day, September 1938, and he spoke about esoteric matters and his disapproval of them, of occultism, and it's in a couple of paragraphs here, and I think it's so good, I think I should read it, so I'm going to try to read right along here and let you hear this, listeners, because this is from Hitler himself in 1938. National Socialism is not a cult movement, a movement for worship. It is exclusively a Volkic political doctrine based upon racial principles. In its purpose, there is no mystic cult, only the care and leadership of a people defined by a common blood relationship. Therefore, we have no rooms for worship, but only halls for the people, no open spaces for worship, but spaces for assemblies and parades. We have no religious retreats, but arenas for sport and playing fields. And the characteristic feature of our places of assembly is not the mystical gloom of a cathedral, but the brightness and light of a room or hall which combines beauty with fitness for its purpose. You know, he may have even had Heinrich Himmler in mind when he decided to make this very clear from himself, because of what Himmler was doing with the SS, which Hitler didn't stop him from doing, but he wasn't into it like that. Anyway, continuing with Hitler, these halls are exclusively devoted to gatherings of the people of the kind which we have come to know in the course of our long struggle. To such gatherings we have become accustomed, and we wish to maintain them. We will not allow mystically minded occult folk with a passion for exploring the secrets of the world beyond to steal into our movement. Such folk are not National Socialists, but something else. In any case, something which has nothing to do with us. At the head of our program, there stand no secret surmisings, but clear-cut perceptions and straightforward professions of belief. But since we set as the central point of this perception and of this profession of belief, maintenance and hence the security for a future of a being formed by God, he said they're concerned with the maintenance and security for a future of a being, he's basically talking about the German being, formed by God, we thus serve the maintenance of a divine work and fulfill a divine will, not in the secret twilight of a new house of worship, but openly before the face of the Lord. And then I'll just give the highlights of the next paragraph rather than read it all, but he says, what reveals the true essence of the spirit of this age is what they're about. He says the mysticism of Christianity demanded certain kind of buildings and architecture and gloomy type, and that's been protested probably in the Protestant Revolution and so on. And we now have new forms of expression. He finally says at the end, the unsteady groping transition of the 19th century led finally in our days to that crisis which in one way or another had to find its solution. Jewry, with its Bolshevist onslaught, might smash the Aryan states and destroy those native strata of the people whose blood destined them for leadership. And in that case, the culture which had hitherto sprung from these roots would be brought to the same destruction. So, again, he points to the Bolshevik as the enemy, and that means Jewry as the enemy. And that was located in Russia at the time and had taken over and a lot of that territory. So that was the enemy. That was the enemy for him. He didn't make it into a spiritual battle at all.
Back to Sibetendorf, was he not involved in the kidnapping of Kurt Eisner or something? I mean,
there's something here.
They're concerned about the Bolshevik Soviet in Bavaria, right? The Bavarian.
Yeah. Well, that was back in the beginning, and that was the Thule Society. He had that. They had become Volkish and for the German people, and then they. I have that all written here somewhere, but there was a. I'll just paraphrase it. The six or eight. Eight members of the Thule Society were arrested for whatever they were doing, you know, protesting or doing something or doing some secret thing or something. But they were arrested by the administration of this Kurt Eisner, and then they were executed as being against his government. And in retaliation for that, what did you say they did?
Well, they overthrew the Freikorps. Overthrew the Kurt Eisner's government, did it not?
Well, yeah, but that wasn't the Thule Society that did
no.
it. They were all for that, yeah.
But I'm not clear on exactly.
They did some kind of an uprising. I can't find it.
Did Sibetendorf have anything to do with the death of Walter Rathenau? You know, the economist that was assassinated?
I don't know. You know, I don't think he was so, powerful or such a great leader or anything.
Sibetendorf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I just read that they were in their meetings, they were discussing how to get rid of this Bolshevism up in Bavaria.
Yes. Yeah. They were. They were very much opposed to it.
Then six of them were, executed. I mean, there were spies. I guess they were caught as spies or plotters or espionage agents
or
something.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right.
Then, Eisner's kicked out and Rathenau's assassinated, so I'm just not clear on the timeline, but.
Well, they were engaging in that kind of thing, but there was also the Freikorps doing a lot, and there was the military that wasn't a part of the Freikorps necessarily was also engaging in things. So there was a lot of intrigue going on around then. I don't know that we can say, exactly who was responsible for everything. Probably different people.
I read too that back to the Thule Society that it was for upper class men, and then he decided that he was going to try to appeal to the workers. So he did that.
Well, yeah, the people who were attracted were like even aristocrats, Germans, because it was all pro German, and the workers were all caught up with the commun. You know, were being the communists were having success with the working class.
Yeah,
so there was a good thing there where they said we need to attract the workers, and then they formed that DAP, and that one man whose name I can't think of right at the moment either started it.
Willie Ley, or not Willie Ley,
no,
but
no, that one who was who were Anton Drexler.
Oh,
he supposedly was the head of it, started it, but he must have been working with these other groups. And Karl Harrer was also one. They established the German Workers' Party for that very reason, to attract working people. So that was just beginning. When Hitler went to it, it was started on January 5th, 1919. It was a year. It was a year later. Started on January 1919, and in February 1920, Hitler had changed it to the NSDAP. So I don't know how... he was a member for a while, but I don't know when he joined. Now I don't have that down. But here it says, early in 1920, Karl Harrer was forced out of the DAP as Hitler moved to sever the party's links with the Thule Society. So Karl Harrer was involved with the Thule, and in early 1920, what it says here, February 1920, Hitler had taken over, and he severed the links with the Thule Society. And after that, the Thule Society fell into decline. And 5 years later, it was dissolved, well before the time that Hitler came to power. So I think we just want to establish that he wasn't supportive of that at all. Now, about the Vril Society, we need to say a few words about the Vril Society, because while there was some connection between the Thule Society and the NSDAP, and it was a group that, as we pointed out, had to do with a lot of things, had a lot of members and so on. But this Vril Society was pretty much of a big nothing that people like read about and imagine had something to do with things. And there's this woman, Maria Orsich, who is played up as some kind of a spiritualist, big-time powerhouse or something. She was just a girl from Austria in the empire. Let me go on to read about this woman, Maria. Okay, Maria, she was born in Vienna. Her father was a Croatian immigrant from Zagreb, and her mother was from Vienna. But it doesn't tell us what her mother's ethnicity was, just that she was from Vienna. But Maria was turned on by the German national movement, and she was obviously a bright young woman, and she became active in German nationalism. The main goal at that time was to annex Austria with the German Reich. We know that's true. They wanted to do that following World War I and up until it finally happened. So in 1919, this Maria moved to Munich to where her boyfriend was, and who later became her fiancé. They didn't marry, but supposedly they both disappeared in 1945. See, now you get all this mysterious stuff about her that there's no sources for it. There's no proof that I could find of any of this, because there's no footnotes given to it or anything. But she was in contact with the Thule Society, and then she created her own circle together with a girl named Traute A. from Munich and a few friends, and they named it something, but the official name was the Vril Society. It was actually the all-German Society for Metaphysics. They called it the Vril Society. And then she was supposed to be a medium. You know, she was a medium, and so they had mediumistic sessions. And she claimed to have received transmissions in a secret German Templar script. And the witnesses said that she wrote these things down. And she was just a simple girl. She would never know this script, but it turned out to be correct. And these telepathic messages had their origin in Aldebaran, a solar system 68 light years away from the constellation Taurus. Well, I used to believe that we got messages from all over the place like this, but I just don't find it important anymore. This stuff can just be made up, and it's but not very likely that all this is going on. So,
Carolyn, it was going on, but it wasn't going on in the political sphere. I mean, because
No, I don't mean that this didn't happen, that this wasn't going on. I mean that this
was a lot of going on.
I mean that messages from Aldebaran to this little group here probably weren't going on. What do you think?
I didn't hear you. What did you say?
Messages from the solar system Aldebaran, 68 light years away in the constellation Taurus. I'm saying that was probably not going on.
Oh, okay, yeah. But
they thought they were getting them, and they said they were getting them. That was
all. People thought that they were getting messages from all kinds of places.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, see, I said I've been involved in that myself, and very accepting of it and so on, because it's all a lot of good wisdom and so on. It sounds good. All this can just be coming from our own inner self. I mean, we don't have to actually be listening to someone from another solar system.
Right.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting about Corina Treidel's book, Occultism and the Genesis of the German Modern, was her, and I didn't read it, I just read about it, and I saw it on sale at a art museum here where I live in conjunction with the Franz von Stuck art show that they put on. And she's saying that modernity was the reason why so many people were looking towards these occult alternative religions and cults, because things were becoming more and more mechanized, and scientism was, you know, replacing, or the scientific technological was replacing their Christianity and some of the foundation beliefs of those societies in Europe, you know.
Well, they're looking for an explanation. You know, these historians and book writers and so on, they always have to have their, to make it acceptable academically, they then look for the reasons behind why things are happening. And they can always come up with that, because I know they've all said, others have said that mysticism and interest in the occult always comes up during times of social upheaval, which would be when people feel insecure and they don't know what to believe in. Then they turn to this stuff. But this has been going on for the entire history of mankind. I think it's just part of our interest. I mean, it might become more accepted socially during these times of upheaval or changes in like you say, modernity and so on.
Right.
It probably, you know, takes hold of more people then. But there was certainly that going on in the 1980s. And I don't know if it was this. It's always going on somewhere.
But there was a renaissance of it at the turn of the last century, from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. It was.
Yeah. That was a big, big, big time for it. You're right. Well, we got our 60-second warning, so we're going to be going to our break. But I just think that we get involved in it. There's nothing wrong if people want to get involved in it. My thing today is that don't involve Hitler and National Socialism into it. And that's what I'm trying to talk about here, that he didn't really belong in that. He didn't want to be a part of that. But people want to pull him into their interest in that. So when we get back, then we've pretty much covered this real society, although I've got a few more things that are interesting here. And then we can go on to the Anunnaki. How's that?
On to what?
Anunnaki.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay, we'll be back in 5 minutes.
The valley so low, hang your head round me, give my heart ease.
Give my heart ease, dear. Give my heart ease. Throw your arms round me. Give my heart ease.
Roses love sun. Violets love dew, angels in heaven know I love you, know I love you, dear, know I love you, angels in heaven know. This valley, they say you are leaving. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile. For they say you are taking the sunshine that has brightened our pathway once. and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true. For a long time, my darling, I've waited for the sweet words. That you're going away. How about a mandolin solo? The verse that that makes me think I kind of know why the guy's going away. Because she is whining. Do you think of the valley you're leaving? Oh, how lonely, how drear it will be. Do you think of the kind heart you're breaking? And the pain that you're causing to me. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true.
Take it, friend. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn and also my guest, Charles Kraft. And, you know, Charles, I realize that there's something I kind of left out here that I want to cover before we go on about the Vril Society, because it actually, the idea actually came from an 1871 novel by Edward Bulwer Lytton, which is called The Power of the Coming Race. Vril, The Power of the Coming Race. And it was very popular. It's basically the story. It's a novel. Let's remember, it's a novel about a young American adventurer who discovers a portal to an underground world at the bottom of a mine shaft. And in this world lives a highly advanced race with a dark secret. Now, this is one of the most popular themes probably in all humanity that comes up again and again, that they discover this other advanced race, and then we learn all kinds of things from it. And I'm not saying it can't be so. I'm only saying it doesn't really have anything to do with National Socialism. When this book became popular, as you were talking about these things in the 19th century, the latter part of the 19th century, the word Vril came to be associated with life-giving elixirs. They had something called Bovril, a blend of bovine and Vril, which they must have got something from bovines that became some life-giving elixir. And then there was a Vrilia Bazaar held at the Royal Albert Hall in London. So this was big in Britain. And of course, then the Theosophists became very popular. Helena Blavatsky, William Scott Elliott, and Rudolf Steiner, who I already mentioned, they liked that book. And there was you know about the book, The Morning of the Magicians, that came out in 1960, and suggested in there that a secret Vril society existed in pre-Nazi Berlin. But you see, there was nothing. It was just this little bitty organization. But our friend C. Bottendorf comes up again. There's also, Vril has been associated with Nazi UFOs and the Black Sun concept. Well, both those are very, very popular. And supposedly you have this secret energy source or whatever, make them work and so on. But it's always basically mythology. And then the movies, which you might want to mention, the Iron Sky, which Ingrid Zundel was talking about a couple of years ago.
What'd you say about Iron Sky? I didn't like it.
I didn't like what I read about it, and I don't like the whole idea of it. But she said, she was promoting it, saying, oh, there's wonderful things going on, like she always does, because she and Ernst go into the UFO stuff. Oh. So, and you know, Ernst Zundel said, I read, that he said he was just doing that to make money because it was so popular at the time. So he was writing these books about Nazi UFOs, and now people want to take him seriously. Well, I guess Ingrid kind of does, and maybe she's just looking for readers too, but she did an interview with the man who made the movie. See, I think all this stuff is distracting and harmful to us.
Well, it's a post-war fantasy genre. Keep that in mind. And it's sort of like it's a comic book.
Yeah. So, well, that's good. What about the Black Sun? You have any thoughts about the importance of the Black Sun?
I don't know anything. I really don't know too much about it.
Well, there's this symbol. There's this,
About that wheel.
That wheel symbol that people love and want to make something out of it. Like it represents us or it represents Aryans.
Wasn't that at, the Wellsburg Castle where
They have it there. Yeah, it's there. I didn't look to find out exactly where it originated, but this Goodrick Clark has written a book about it.
They have, when I was in Slovenia, they have one in the downtown post office in the floor.
Uh-huh.
So it's, related, I guess, to European history in some fashion, but I don't know the occult ramifications of it all.
Well, we'll have to do a show on that one of these days because we're not able to say anything much about it.
Yeah.
So the other thing about this real society, here's a story that they put out. Now, these websites, you go looking this up and you just come on these websites and they write this stuff. There's this website all about Maria Orsic and they wrote this story. No footnotes, no references to where this comes from. So to me, it's just made up. And they say in late November 1924, Maria visited Rudolf Hess in his apartment in Munich and together with Sibatendorf. Sibatendorf took Maria, supposedly, to Hess's apartment. And Sibatendorf wanted to contact Dietrich Eckart, who had died 1 year before. So some other members of the Thule Society were there with them, and they tried to establish contact with Eckart around a table. They sat around a table, and I guess Hess was just watching from somewhere else in the room. And soon, she went into her medium trance, and her head fell back, and she started speaking in Eckart's voice. And then he said, well, there was someone else there and they were talking about the Aldebaran project, and said there was somebody else who wanted to speak, and it turned out to be someone from, let's see, who is this, light years away in another dimension who at one time spent some time on the earth plane. All these people are flying around. And then in 1944, according to them, there was, now listen to this. Now I see this is just terrible. They said there was January 1944, there was a meeting between Himmler, Dr. Schumann, a scientist and professor at the Technical University of Munich, and Kunkel of the Vril Society. And these four people, Himmler and these two guys, decided that a Vril 7 Jaeger would be sent through a dimension channel independent of the speed of light to Aldebaran, and that this test flight took place, and it almost ended in disaster because when the Vril 7 got to Aldebaran, it looked as if it had been flying for 100 years. It was damaged and so on. Or else it flew back here and looked that way. I'm not sure. But, who would believe that? But some people will believe it. This is what's so sad about this. They'll believe in the whole thing, and then this is just a part of it, so they believe this kind of too a little bit. Then she disappeared supposedly in 1945. And they said, now we're supposed to believe that she and her boyfriend disappeared and they escaped to Aldebaran in 1945. So that's that.
What's Aldebaran? I'm not familiar with it.
Again, that's that galaxy in this constellation Taurus, 68 light years away.
Oh, okay.
Fine. Yeah. So were you going to say something then?
Well, I was going to bring up William Dudley Pelley, who's an interesting case of a Nazi medium. I mean, we don't like to, you don't want to use the word Nazi, but he was a isolationist, pro-German, American fascist that was put into prison for sedition during the World War II. He started the Silver Shirts, and when he came out of prison 7 years later, he was a medium, and he spent the rest of his life in mediumistic activities, and I think in Noblesville, Indiana. Anyway, so people believe all kinds of...
I believe mediums are actually coming forth with something good. I don't know that it... Because of the openness of spirit, you know, it could be anyone. It could be someone. If they wanted to come through, you know, speak to someone, that can happen. Or it could be a wisdom that they get in touch with through their own self. That they themselves, when they're freed from the, you know, when we're freed from the confines of time and space, just let ourselves go, all kinds of wisdom can come through and good things. But when people start following it and as though one person has these magical powers, you know, it's not, well, my thing basically is that it's not magical, that it's just a part of the natural order, more about the natural order, the way we're made, because there's not only this. There's not only the physical world. Somewhere I've noticed, somewhere in Table Talk, I think it's coming up in Table Talk, Hitler mentions reincarnation in a way that somebody might be reincarnated. Not in some big believing way, but not in a not believing way either. And now myself personally, I probably shouldn't be getting into this, but I do believe reincarnation is the best explanation for how life goes on, better than anything else. It sure is better than this heaven that people go to, or any kind of a place, even Valhalla, where you go and you just stay there without changing any ever, because life is all about change, and it's always changing, moving, doesn't stand still. So anyway, so I'm open to all that. But what I dispute, as I say one more time, I dispute occult Nazism and esoteric Nazism and all that kind of thing, because Adolf Hitler would not approve of it.
Have you heard about Andreas Serrano?
Yeah, now that's, I don't like
it's
his stuff.
Andreas, it's a Michael Serrano.
Michael Serrano. I was going to bring him up too. Yeah, a lot of people like him, and they point to that as though somehow what he writes is just absolutely spot on or right. Well, I don't know why they think so.
I don't either. I can't make heads or tails of this philosophy of his.
I thought, oh, that sounds interesting, you know, quite a few years ago, and I started reading. I was just reading on the internet though, and I just didn't like it. Yeah, I didn't get anything from it either.
Well, he likes Savitri Devi. You've heard of her, have you?
Oh yeah.
Well, they both think of Hitler as a avatar. We got to remember that the Germans were interested in the East even before, you know, the rise of Hitler. There was quite a bit of study, you know, of Sanskrit and that kind of thing going on in the academy.
The Vedic philosophy.
Yeah.
There's a heck of a lot of great stuff there.
Max Müller was one of the greatest Indologists, I think, of the 19th century. Everybody, when you get into Indology and such, the name Max Müller comes up. But anyway, they had an affinity for this, and their scholars were looking into it. So,
I think that's good. See, I don't see anything wrong with looking into Hinduism and the higher levels of Hinduism, like Vedism or the Vedic philosophy and all of that. And, of course, you don't, because you've been to India I don't know how many times. You study that, so I mean that's fine, but it's not the same as occult. The thing is, this word occult is so strange, and it goes all the way from people thinking that it's about the roots of Arianism. Well, let's go on then to what I said, the Himmler and the Anunnaki, and what that was all about. Himmler established that to study these very things.
The only thing I can bring to this part of the discussion would be the name of Julius Evola, who was an Italian that was brought to Germany to work with the Anunnaki on Masonic, cataloging Masonic information, I guess.
Well, let's just tell the listeners that the Annenerbe was an institute in National Socialist Germany to research the archaeological and cultural history of the Germanic race. It was founded in 1935, July 1st, 1935, by Heinrich Himmler, Hermann Wirth, and Richard Dare, who was the head of the Food and Agricultural Ministry of Hitler's government. And he was a very enthusiastic National Socialist. He was in the SS. They were all in the SS. And Annenerbe was run by the SS, under the SS. And they conducted experiments and launched expeditions. See, I don't see anything wrong with that, anything that they did. I've got a whole list of things that they did. And there's nothing wrong with any of them, but people make it into something occult and mystical when it really was not. That's my opinion of it.
I agree with you. Okay. I think it's just business as usual in the various disciplines of academia, I guess.
Right.
And they're under a National Socialist government. So, I mean, it's just scholars looking for information.
Yeah, see, because it's part of the SS and it's under in a National Socialist government, that's why people, and not our own people who are interested in it, but enemies too, want to depict it as some kind of occult weird stuff that Heinrich Himmler was doing. And they'll either say, well, he was doing this in opposition to Hitler, or Hitler was also into it too. You know, one or the other. They just can't look at anything direct, you know, as it might really be. They have to put all these meanings and bring all their propaganda with them into it.
Well, they love to call it pseudoscience, and I don't understand why it's a pseudoscience.
Everything on Wikipedia about all this is a pseudoscience. I just threw that word out because
Freudianism is a pseudoscience. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, and some of this other stuff, Wilhelm Reich and his ideas about orgone energy, that would be a pseudoscience to me, but I don't understand about an expedition to, let's say, Tibet, which the SS Annenerbe made. What's pseudo about that? They had to, you know, nothing as far as I'm concerned.
No, it's all very solid, so.
Yeah, it was very solid. They kept their field notes, and they did it all by the book as anthropologists.
Yeah, I read that Annenerbe had several different institutes or sections, one of which was archaeology or the archaeological one, but they also had a meteorology section, which was used to provide accurate long-range weather forecasts. Now, that would be very helpful militarily, and a section devoted to musicology. And the aim there was to determine the essence of German music.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was all into what are our roots, you know, our German roots. It does, not necessarily occult roots, but sometimes it got into that because there were stories and things passed down that were really more like myths and so on. But they, you know, that was all part of their research.
Well, remember, too, that in the world of physics, I can't remember who wrote about it, but I remember running across this information about the difference between German physics and Jewish physics. Have you ever run into that? Because they were looking for Jewish influences in the culture and in the sciences, and there were some of these hardcore National Socialist scientists and musicians and others were trying to find out what the difference was between what they thought was German and what they thought was Jewish.
Yeah, well, that was a good thing. I mean, but see, the normal population and the pro-Jewish thinking would see that as just terrible.
Well, they would see that as anti-Semitic, is what they would see it as.
Yeah, but also pseudoscience.
Yeah, another pseudoscience.
You know, another thing they had in the SS was the Race and Settlement Office, Russia, which gets a lot of criticism about being, you know, more pseudoscience and so on, where they were studying race and who settled where, I guess, what races were where or what different ethnicities existed here, there, and wherever. That was headed by this Dare, who was pretty...
You know, Dare was the father of ecology. And you can look at the history of the ecological thinking, and Richard Dare factors into it. So his appreciation for the environment sort of launched the whole idea of trying to preserve it.
Well, yeah, I think he was a very good man, and he was that whole blood and soil. Blood and sorrel was used as kind of the motto or the slogan or whatever for the food and agricultural ministry. He was very energetic and totally devoted to the race, I guess.
Do you have any idea what happened to him after the war? I'm always interested to find out how these guys ended their lives.
Look him up real quick on Wikipedia and see what it says.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to say this thing about the Totenkopf. That's another thing they like to get into, being so mystical or something strange or weird. Well, the Totenkopf, or the death's head that the SS used, had been used by the German military units for hundreds of years. Hundreds of years it had been a German thing. Himmler selected it, I guess, but he didn't dream it up. And also to recall that Himmler was not involved with Nazi party policy making leading up to Hitler's taking over the government in 1933. But this idea that Himmler was doing things separate from Hitler and he was running the show, and somebody even said that, well, told me recently that they thought Himmler was more influential in the National Socialism in the Third Reich, and Hitler was more like king or queen, you know, doing state duties and so on, and Himmler was the real heart of it. Well, just not true. You know, there was the Führerprinzip, required obedience of all subordinates to their superiors, and Himmler placed himself in a position of subservience to Hitler and was unconditionally obedient to him. That's what how everybody did, and that's what you had to be to the person who was above you. Did you find it?
Yeah, Dare died in 1950 in a Munich hospital, 1953, of cancer of the liver after being sentenced to 7 years at Nuremberg and spending those 7 years in Landsberg prison.
Oh, and then when he got out of prison, he had cancer and he died.
Yeah.
Well, at least in Landsberg prison, Hermann Giesler was there too, and Speer was there. A whole bunch of them were there, and they got to see each other when they're out in their hour a day in the yard there, while you could walk around and so on, move yourself around. So they could talk to the people they liked and didn't talk to the people they didn't like. So,
Speer moved to Spandau?
Well, he was there for a while. I mean, he was in Landsberg for a while because Giesler said he avoided him. But, you know, Giesler wasn't in as long as Speer was. I think Giesler got a long sentence, like maybe life or something. But he was one of those people that after a couple years or 2 or 3 years, they released him. Because they didn't really have any reason to have him in prison anyway.
Yeah.
So they released a lot of people ahead of time. But they wanted to keep him out. They wanted to keep control over him for a few years anyway, probably after the end of the war, up until around 49 or 50 or so, before they let him go back out into the public. I've got some stuff here about Heinrich Himmler, and what about some of the things you had? Please go ahead with that. About any of these books that promote the idea of occult Nazism and so on.
When we were corresponding before the show, the name that came to mind immediately was Alec Howe, who wrote a book called Urania's Children, and he worked for British intelligence. And one of his jobs with British intelligence was to leaflet Germany with fake astrological horoscopes that would lead the people that liked astrology to believe that certain things were going to happen or were not going to happen. And they had astrological digests, just like they do today, that they sold on the newsstands. And Alec Howe was tasked to counterfeit these and rearrange these predictions and prognostications and then drop them over Germany and mislead the people that believed in astrology. So after the war, he got into writing about Nazi occultism a little bit. And one of the first books that he wrote was about a German astrologer named Karl Kraft, who was Swiss and who disappeared like that woman you were just speaking about.
Yeah.
Not much is known about what happened to Karl Kraft, but supposedly he
he was taken to another galaxy.
Well, I think he died. He may have died in a concentration camp, and you know, unrecorded or something. But I probably should go back and read the book or reread about the book. But anyway, Alec Howe was this intelligence agent, and like many of those British intelligence agents, they really put out a lot of books. Ian Fleming was one of them, and Roald Dahl was one of them, and this Alec Howe was part of Sefton Delmer's black propaganda department in the political warfare executive. It sort of launched this genre, which, you know, has become elaborated on as we get farther and farther away from, you know, 1945 and the period. And a good example of how far it's gotten is would be Steven Spielberg's movie, The Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you know, with these Nazis in a submarine base somewhere in the middle of the ocean, protecting the Ark of the Covenant and all this magic and mystery that surrounds the power of the Ark. And there was in the 60s, The Morning of the Magicians came out, and The Spear of Destiny. Trevor Ravenscroft was another British kind of occult writer, and he wrote this book that everybody was reading, and I remember reading it back then, about Christ's spear that Hitler was after, and anybody that has the hold of this spear has world power.
And Hitler was after it. And these are all fictional books, aren't they?
Well, they're sort of half fiction and half nonfiction, because they're anchored in a little bit of truth. Because apparently there is a spear of destiny, or this spear, and I can't remember the name of the spear right now, but Morning of the Magicians and The Spear of Destiny were two big books that connected National Socialism with the occult, and sort of gave National Socialism this veneer of sinister evil power, you know, that was supernatural, and that these guys were in touch with some kind of demiurge or satanic energy that they were using, and then ultimately they were going to control the world with it or whatever. But Michael Aquino was a member of Anton LaVey's Church of Satan, who was broke off and started something called the Temple of Set, and he was an American intelligence officer who was very involved in the idea of the Wellsburg SS Teutonic Order of Knights. Michael Serrano was this guy who was an ambassador from Chile until, I think, around 1970, maybe. He was removed by Allende, I remember reading. But he had met Carl Jung, and he had met Hermann Hesse, and he was steeped in all kinds of psychological and occult thinking, and he put out a lot of books. There's a interesting writer right now named Joseph P. Farrell, who started out as an expert on Orthodox Christianity, and he sort of drifted into this new area of Nazi technology, and what's really popular, I've noticed, is the idea of the Nazis having, I know you don't want me to say Nazi, but
go ahead.
Well, anyway, they've got some sort of handle on anti-gravity, and there's a whole secret it gets really far-fetched. They were in touch with extraterrestrials. The extraterrestrials gave them the secret to anti-gravity, and they had an anti-gravity bell, and we got the anti-gravity secret from these guys, and we're using it somehow, and there's all kinds of cosmic warring going on in the universe that light years away from ours, and we're just a part of it, and it gets pretty fantastic. But Joseph P. Farrell, I was interested to learn, was started out writing about the history of Christian Orthodoxy, the Orthodox Church, and he's got a PhD in patristics, which I have to look up. It's got something to do with, you know, the difference between the Eastern Orthodox Church and Catholicism. So he started off sort of in the religious realm, theology, and now he's very popular in this sci-fi Nazism, you know, which is harkens back to that movie, The Iron Sky, where the Nazis have been on the moon since the end of the war, and they're coming back in these spaceships to attack us.
Now, what gets me, Charles, is that there's a lot of people who say and that they really believe that, or they indulge it. They think it might be so. And Marcus, who is a sensible person, I like him. He indicates that he does quite often.
Marcus who? Who are you talking about?
Well, he's Allen. We don't know his last name. He comments at the White Network, but he's a listener, and he comments other places too.
There's another guy that's interesting too that has something kind of tangentially to do with religion, and his name is Peter Lavenda, and he's wrote a book that was pretty popular called Unholy Alliance: A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult, and you get this stuff sort of reiterated on George Norrie's Coast to Coast show. Remember Art Bell and that?
Yeah, right.
That kind of That's, thing.
Yeah, I never listened to him. I mean, I heard bits and pieces here and there, but I didn't, wasn't able to actually listen to that show. It's a good thing.
Well, every once in a while, one of these authors that's deeply steeped in this Nazi occultism will be a guest on Coast to Coast, and they'll bring up all this information, which some of it's true and some of it's just, you know, pure, as far as I can tell, you know, some kind of fantasy.
Yeah.
It's sort of science fiction now. That's what I'd say.
It's basically science fiction, and science fiction is so popular. See, now there's another thing. I don't hate science fiction, but I bet I've read maybe two science fiction books in my life, if that. I mean, I just don't choose it. I have never selected it, so it's not my thing. But for some people, it is. And that's why they like this stuff. And some people start to not tell the difference between the fiction.
And the science fiction, Ferrell, if you listen to him, I mean, you believe him because he seems to be so knowledgeable about this stuff. And that's.
And now, what was the name of this Peter Lavenda book, History of Nazi Alliance with the Occult?
The Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. And that's got this, one of the things that they've done is tied Nazism to Satanism. And so you get this idea of Nazis being practicing Satanists. Somehow, I mean, they're making a connection between something very sinister and then, you know, the National Socialists. So
again, a reason they always use the word Nazi, they would anyway, but I mean, you know, they're in these books and all of these kinds of things, Nazi goes together with these words and these ideas, but National Socialist really doesn't.
Right.
You know, I mean, right away, National Socialist, you have some meaning there that doesn't have anything to do with occultism.
Well, there's this occultism, and then there's this fetishism, you know, the sadomasochistic sexuality where you're dressing up as Nazis doing, you know, things to each other in a sexual role playing. That sort of came out of a Dirk Bogarde film called The Night Porter. It exploded, you know. I mean, all of a sudden, everybody that's into S&M is dressing up like SS, boys and girls. It's crazy.
See, this stuff it appeals to some of the lowest of our instincts and our appetite, what turns us on or whatever. It appeals to this. You can start out with just simple kind of science fiction or simple kind of National Socialist ideas or something. And you work your way all the way down to sadomasochism. You know, and who's behind this? I mean, this kind of comic book stuff is generally Jews. I mean, they're the ones that do this, and they've done so much damage. They've been very, very successful against the Hitler idea through comic books.
Well, they started they launched a genre of softcore concentration camp pornography in Israel called the Stalags, which were very lurid stories about sadomasochistic situations in concentration camps, always featuring a very powerful female lording it over a less powerful male.
Yeah.
And there's actually a good movie that was made in Israel about these Stalags, which were comic books that based on the pulp men's magazines of the 50s. You remember seeing those with the gals in scantily clad girls that are wearing armbands and such.
Well, I saw lots of weird stuff in the 50s, but I don't know if I don't recall explicitly that it was Nazi symbology with it.
Oh, man, there's a book that Ta Shan has put out about men's adventure magazines, and there's an entire section of it is just devoted to Nazi evil.
Yeah.
And lots of illustrators were busy creating this idea, you know, of sexuality and national socialism connected to sadism. But anyway, that's beside the point. What I wanted to say, though, before I just drop this, is that in that movie Stalags, they show you how at the Eichmann trial, some of the eyewitnesses were just repeating what they'd read in these digests that they'd bought on newsstands in Tel Aviv. I mean, this stuff was regurgitated on the witness stand. And the filmmaker actually makes a case for how it sort of slipped into these people's subconscious to the point where they believed they actually lived through some of the stuff that they'd read about, which was pure fiction. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Because, you know, now that was a movie called Stalag.
Stalags. That's the name of the genre of pulp, softcore, pornographic fiction that they were selling in Israel right after in the 1950s. They called them Stalags, S-T-A-L-A-G-S. And it's a movie about it. They took them off the newsstands finally. It's a very interesting movie, actually. But anyway,
Well, do you think that before we move on to the David Cole subject, do you think that there's anyone, any group, anything that's been treated this badly or with this kind of thing?
I can't think of anybody.
As badly as the Nazis have? Yeah, you can't think of anybody.
I can't think of anybody that's been, where they've been, it's the personification of, you know, some kind of pure evil. It's really remarkable the way that it's been connected to evil. In our imagination.
Yeah, previous to this, it would have to be through some kind of religious tracts or something. I don't know how, you know, the devil and so on. I guess you can look back to, I never can think of his name, you know, Peter Bruegel and then his contemporary Dutch painter who did
Albrecht Dürer?
No, the Dutch painter who did those pictures landscapes with all kinds of people doing horrible things to each other and.
Yeah.
Craziness. What's his name?
I don't know, but the name of the painting is isn't that the Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome?
Yeah, but there was he did a lot of them. I can't
think
of
it. Yeah, it's in the Prado. I can't remember his name right now, but I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, people, I wish I did have the name, but you go all the way back to that in like the 1600s to where people who were, the Christian religion was so strong. And these were like supposed to be moralizing paintings, but I don't know anybody that was extreme as him, where he just showed horrible things happening all over people, just the worst vices that people could have and doing terrible things to one another. Some of it was just foolishness, you know. So you had it was almost like, the seven deadly vices or sins or something being pictured, but in a vast landscape with all kinds of, you know, individuals doing these things, and to find the evil that's in human beings. But then we jump to the poor Hitler and his crowd, you know, now becomes the people doing evil to everybody and everything. It's a wonder they don't have comics of them raping dogs or killing animals and destroying the earth, fire-blasting flower beds or something.
Hey, there's a new guy that looks to, you know, Nicholas Goodrich Clark died, I think, in 2011. So he's gone. But there's a new academic you might want to look into named Eric Kurlander, who's got a book coming out on the Yale University Press called Nazi Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich.
The supernatural history?
Yeah, and he's a expert on this supernatural stuff.
Well, he's pointing it out like as a historian saying this is what's been going on. He's not saying that Nazis are monsters.
I think he's tracking maybe the idea of the supernatural Nazi.
Okay. Sounds interesting.
He's got a PhD from Harvard and an MA from Harvard, and the book's not out yet, but I noticed that he's been leading panels at various universities on this subject, and the problem with him is he's footnoting a lot of postmodern philosophers, and I just think that's French post-structuralism and postmodernism. I have a hard time with it because it's a language that I don't understand or talk, but it's academic and it's got a lot to do with
Well, it can't be good if the academic world is doing it, is hosting it.
It's not going to be. You'll just have to use it and take what you need and then discard the rest. Is what I usually tell people to do with these. University Press or Harvard Press. You could get good information out of these books, but they're always going to be slanted. Otherwise, these guys lose their jobs.
Let's go on then. I think we covered that very well, and I appreciate all the information you brought. I took a whole bunch of notes. Let's go on to, because this leads right into the fact that David Cole was kind of talking about some Nazi monsters, some supernatural monster Nazis or something in his interview, which I think just took place yesterday, with Ryan Dawson.
Yeah, well, I don't know when that interview happened, but I have to apologize publicly.
I already mentioned it.
There was a cannibal commandant at Natzweiler Struhoff concentration camp. I thought I heard him say that stuff that I wrote to you.
Well, that just shows how we think we hear things. But if we, as soon as we find out, I mean, I didn't have to put it on there because you mentioned it, and I never actually heard it, but I heard some things and I thought it sounded like that too. I got the idea from you. So that just goes to show how.
I don't even know where I got the idea. I mean,
goes to show how we all are very susceptible to imagining things that we've heard and then thinking we heard it if we didn't hear it and things like that. The important thing is when you discover, if you're wanting the truth, you discover that it's wrong that you say so right away, which we're doing. Not that it puts it in a totally different class. It's just a mistake.
I'm embarrassed.
You didn't even have to say that because you didn't put it in writing or anything. So you didn't have to take responsibility for it.
Well, I got right out after I heard that interview and what I thought I heard David Cole say, the first person I wrote about it was to you because I convinced myself that he'd said these things. And then after I went back and re-listened to it, it was something entirely different. So.
Well, then I listened to a part of it and then I convinced myself that I heard it too.
Yeah.
So,
talked about it.
Well, anyway, let's say what he did say though, because we don't have much time left. He did say some things that I disagree with. And first, I'll just go into that. He said this about, Rudolf Huss, who was the famous commandant at Auschwitz who got so badly treated after the war and ended up being hung on the gallows in Auschwitz. But he started saying how he was, this is not maybe exact quote, but it's very close, David Cole talking on this interview. I do think Huss killed people. He calls him Hearse. He says, he pronounces it Hearse. So that's what I'm talking about. I do think Huss killed people. He was actually a very corrupt man who was investigated by the SS and removed from his office at Auschwitz he had to vent. I'm not saying that no murders happened. It takes a certain kind of person, a mindset. Well, after he said, I'm not saying that no murders happened, he said something about terrible things happened. You know, bad things happened to the Jews. And he said, it takes a certain kind of person, a certain mindset to do that kind of thing to other people or to even be a commandant of a concentration camp. But he said, apart from being that, the commandant of the camp, he was a really bad guy. He says, and I've never heard that from anybody. Then he said Huss was removed from duty by the SS when they did an investigation and he had these charges against him. Well, I thought that might be true because some of them were. But I looked it up and I didn't find anything about Rudolf Huss being removed by the SS and charged with things, bad things, doing bad things. And David Cole made it out to be really bad. Then he even said...
I think he got him confused with Ilse Koch's. Ilse Koch, is it Koch or Cole?
He shouldn't get things confused. He's a smart guy, and he's pretty careful about what he says. So I can't imagine that he got him confused. I think he thinks this, but I don't know where the evidence is, and I've never heard any other revisionist ever say anything like this. So it's up to him to say whether he got confused with somebody else or, you know, or what, why he's saying this. Then he said there are commandants who are a little kinky. They are into wacky stuff. He used the word kinky and wacky and some other words. Like Huss. He thought Huss was kinky and wacky. I heard there was a particular brigade headed by a crazy guy, known to be violent, sadistic, and over the top. So Himmler ordered an investigation into soap rumors. He was saying that there were all these soap rumors, and that Himmler finally said, finally asked one of his people, are we doing this? Because he thought they were just rumors, but he heard so many of them, he started to wonder. So Cole is saying that those aren't believable. Of course they're not, but he was just, again, trying to point out that there were commandants of these camps who were kinky, wacky, and doing bad things. I think that's overdone myself. But,
well, then he went on to discuss this gas chamber at Netzwatt.
Right.
And some kind of a, what did Dr. Hurt ordered these, what? He ordered these people killed so he could make some kind of a...
Well, here's the thing. I wrote to Germar Rudolph about that.
Yeah.
And he was kind enough to send me some information on it. And I'm just going to read, because this makes it pretty clear here how it should be presented. He said that Carlo Mattogno had written a book, but it hasn't been published yet. It's been held back for a number of reasons, but not because of the Struthoff-Natzweiler issue. But he says that Mattogno and Graf, because of what's in this book, probably agree with Cole on Natzweiler in general, which is that he describes it down below here. But not all other revisionists do. Maybe he doesn't describe it. So we better say what it was, is that this Dr. Hurt had this idea to develop this Jewish skeleton exhibit. And so he ordered 100 Jews from Auschwitz, live Jews. I forget now why they had to be live. No, that so they weren't shot in the head. He wanted to deflesh the skulls. See, there's a couple of stories. One, he wanted to deflesh the skulls and study the skulls and have a skull exhibit. And then other places it's called a skeleton exhibit, as if he wanted to deflesh all the bodies after they were. And so they built this gas chamber there and they gassed them there. And supposedly there's all this paperwork that exists. And so what Graf wrote in the foreword to this book is, as stated above, this merciless judgment of the failure of Orthodox historiography does not apply to the authors of the chapters on euthanasia. Neither Mattogno nor I can assess this topic. We also have to exempt from the accusation the author of the chapter Die Gaskammer in the gas chamber in the Natzweiler concentration camp. They're exempting this from saying that Orthodox historiography has totally failed its duty. Because they are, for myself, Graf says, who translated Mattogno's book from Italian to German, the conclusion that a gassing was probably perpetrated in the Natzweiler camp was very surprising. It was surprising to him, but he says there are documents, and the documents do not permit any doubt. He himself says that. That's what Cole was saying, that the documents are unassailable. And he says that this criminal deed was initiated by an SS professor who wanted to prepare a collection of Jewish skeletons, but whether skeletons or skulls, I don't know. But he says, without providing any clear documentary evidence, Mattogno believes that these murders were probably carried out by means of gas, but he calls it a hypothesis, and that Mattogno risks being rebuked by other revisionist historians, but that he doesn't want to not be scientific about it. So I think it's questionable. I don't think it's a proven thing, but we've run out of time, Charles.
Okay.
Started this too late.
All right. Bye-bye.
Too bad. Thanks very much for being on.